feel like this is the setup for someone who's doing the interview in Mad Men.
It's the Stuart Lucy podcast. Here we go with stories of teachers that are inspirational. I'm learning everything I know and learning all over again.
So my first guest is a man that I've been working with for the last couple of years in the drama department. And he is an incredibly kooky cat, very smart, and perfect person to have to sort of pick apart your brain. There's a lot to go through, and there's a lot of rabbit warrens in there. So I'll let Remy sort of qualify himself throughout the chat, because his life story is obviously what we want to hear about. We'll hear about what makes Remy the educator that he is. But this is Remy Graham Throssell, and I'm very proud to have him for a walk and talk. Welcome.
Yeah, I like the intro of a kooky cat.
Yeah.
I like that especially because probably not all that many people would call me that anymore. Yeah. But yeah. That was absolutely my image when you first met me in undergrad. You're like, there's that weird guy who knows stuff.
He's a bit of a kooky cat.
Definitely.
I would like to think that most drama teachers would like to be called a kooky cat.
I think you need a sprinkling of kookiness in there, otherwise you're probably not really committing to that.
I'd get a long back, please.
And I'll get a strong latte in there, please. I'll get these ones. Is it? You got the last one. Okay. No, it's my turn. I remember. Yeah.
Before we go into this, you are a professional director. You have directed outside of an educational environment, and you have completed your Masters of Directing?
Correct.
Yeah. At the VCA, so the Victorian College of the Arts. So
I don't know how professional I count as being, but I've done work outside of schools in theatre, yes.
And in terms of like school drama teachers, etc., you would be, as some would say, overqualified in that context. So
teaching's harder than directing, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Depending on what metric you're using.
Exactly. So talk to us about that from the perspective of someone who really knows what they're talking about. Continue that line of thought.
Yeah, no, that's right. So what I was thinking about was you get an option to do an internship, a couple if you're industrious, through that directing program.
Yeah.
And one of the ones I looked at was the VCA Secondary School. So to take, because I'd been a teacher already, to take that experience into a school that's dedicated to performing arts. If you look at the rankings and that sort of thing, if you want students doing drama, theatre, 3-4 VCE subjects, the top of the top tend to come out of that school, because they spend six years with the vocabulary, the terminology, the understanding, the format, and a lot of them then go straight into the VCA acting programs afterwards. That, you know, there's a merit to dedicating that much time. The reason I was interested in that is because I wanted to spend more time immersed in a subject rather than tagging in and out of it. Mm. As you know, I can teach in a couple of different disciplines.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's a blessing and a curse, because
you're the Leatherman of the teaching world. You know everything.
Not maths and science, but otherwise I'm all right. The scattershot approach, I think, rattles my brain a little bit, because if you're swapping discipline, key skills, vocab, understanding, you know, as much as 4 or 5 times a day in 4 different subjects, that's already throwing me off a sense of consistency. So I was really interested to see what happens in a school where they do all of those subjects, mm-hmm. but they do them with the end goal of producing theatre students, not necessarily at the expense of other areas, but they've got a really strong focus on that. And that
is it at the expense of other areas, though? I mean, that's an interesting concept.
I couldn't pretend to know without going and doing some digging on output. I don't think their model is, we don't care about the other subjects, we're going to create theatre students. Yeah. I think they try and make holistically well-prepared students whose bent is doing visual art, music, dance, drama, theatre. But it's partly why I wanted to go there and didn't get to spend as much time as I wanted in that headspace, because I wanted to see what it's like. Very few schools have that we are this kind of school targeted approach. I just, in a big picture sense, wanted to balance it against what I'm used to, which is a high school does all the different subjects, and by the end of year 12 you have some rough idea of what you're pretty good at, or a very clear idea of what you're good at. But that's, I think that would be a unique student a lot of the time.
Where is the campus base?
It's down in South Bank. It's near the ABC and
where the college is.
Yeah, and the college, and also around the corner from places like the Malthouse Theatre and MTC area. That whole arts precinct block has the school attached to it.
Let's bring you back to the drama perspective, looking at regional drama.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, because you said there was nothing when you arrived, we're just going to cross Glen Ferry Road.
Yeah, so there's no formal subject being studied in the year that I got there.
Yeah.
I brought in years 7, 8, and 9 drama and a year 12 elective theatre study.
Single-handedly?
Yes.
In the first year?
Yes.
So you walked into a school that had not been teaching drama and took on pretty much a full load of drama in the first year and developed it all in the first year on your own?
Yeah. When you say it like that, it sounds more impressive than it was.
sounds daunting.
It was a busy, busy year.
Yeah.
I couldn't profess to have done especially well at that early on. It was a challenge because you had to encourage a community of people to like something that they didn't really know how it operated at all.
Yeah.
And so, to see a merit over it, for example, compared with football, which is 100% of people's favourite thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, on the surface at least.
Oh, no, I'm being hyperbolic, but, yeah. But the idea being that it was competing with interests from families who hadn't seen necessarily much theatre. Some of them had, but...
And, yeah, I mean, that's interesting. And you put on a production as well as that?
Yeah, so that was the other part of the program I set up, was to build an extracurricular, which started with a show. There were some really keen, really helpful people in the staff who had done various different theatre endeavours of their own at different times. So it wasn't completely devoid of awareness and resources.
But, I mean, that's vital, isn't it? I mean, if there are any staff...
I couldn't do it without it.
Any teachers listening to this and they're like, oh, I'm not sure, I'm not a drama teacher. Just put your hand up, please.
Yeah. Chuck yourself at it.
We love you so much. Please help. There's
endlessly,
so many things that...
Endlessly helpful.
Endlessly helpful. Doesn't matter if you're drama or not. Please, please, if you have a spare moment to give, find your drama teacher in your school and say you'd like to help, because it's just the best gift you could ever give.
Yeah, I think I learned a bit about both those really generous people and the way I operated a little bit when I was first doing that show.
Uh-huh.
Because I didn't know how schools worked. I was, 22?
Yeah.
And was just kind of gung-ho doing everything that I could, biting off more than I could handle and going like at the clappers at it. I realised that my default mode when I'm doing lots and lots of stuff is to be very serious, very focused, and apparently quite intimidating, which I didn't mean to be at all. I was just off in my head trying to get things done. It's called what I call my director's default resting face, is frowning. My brow's not lacking in prominence. So if I'm frowning and looking down, and I'm 6'2", and I'm staring at you, it was brought to my attention that I had that look, because these wonderful, incredible women very, very tentatively came up to me while I was doing something. It was like, just so you know, we're really happy to help. I've been doing costumes for about 17 years. And I was like, oh my God.
You're just very scary.
And they were like, clearly didn't want to step on my toes. And I was like, oh my God, no, that's the best thing in the world.
Thing ever, as if someone's been able to do something in a field and you're offering those services.
It's just, absolutely.
Cannot thank anyone enough.
Could not have done it without them, quite literally.
And I get the furrowed eyebrows look. Every director, especially a school director, gets to the point in the production where they question if this is going to make or break a career. Is this going to be the last thing I ever do before giving up the ghost?
Oh, and there's the death throes of every show before it comes good as well.
You're
sitting in a space of
what have I done?
Some terror. Yeah. Nothing is quite there yet. I had a good directing friend of mine give me the expression that the role of the assistant director is the worst role in the whole show, because your whole job is to watch actors do poorly for 14 to 16 weeks before they go on stage. All you're doing is watching actors fail at something many, many, many times before they get it.
And then they get it.
And no, of course they do, but...
And then they get it, and that's the best feeling ever.
Yes.
And it replaces that dread that was creating the furrowed eyebrows.
Right up until a couple of days out on the show most of the time.
A lot. And I don't know, I haven't directed external to school productions, but I know with school productions it's that frustration you get with students who have a full life. And they've got, as you said, they've got everything going on in their world with sport, academics, social life. And then they've got this play, which is on the side. And while the play's on, it's your life.
Yeah.
So you're like, oh, I don't know. I don't think they're putting in the work that's going to pull off. And then they end up doing it.
Yeah, it's an all-encompassing thing if you let it be. Yeah. Just another thing I learned teaching out in the country was that... you've got to do it within the time you set. Yep. And my previous context had been, all right, so I need to chuck an all-nighter here. I can do the lighting rig up to 5 a.m. when the security guy will come and kick me out of the theatre that I'm working in.
At 5 a.m.
Right. So I could do a 16, 18-hour day in a theatre. Nobody else would be required to be there, of course, but I just had that focus that I would if it needed to happen.
Yeah.
But what I needed to do better was to manage the time leading up to that so that it never needed to happen. And when you've got students, you've got all of the duty of care that comes with that and the timing and the scheduling. So the rule I set myself was, okay, if I'm doing two-hour rehearsals a week, that's it. The show is ready within the time in a term, two-hour rehearsals a week, done. They've got to do other stuff, so I can't take up anyone else's time. And so the show was always ready when it needed to be ready.
And I think it's always at the level of which they put in as well. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I'd be lying if I didn't say on opening night, some of the productions I've done, especially early on in my career, that the kids have sort of got up there a little bit half-cooked.
Oh, of course.
And then they said, oh, I forgot this line. I was like, but the skills that they learnt from that, learning how to deal with the show must go on, and I forget a line, but how do we keep going?
Yes.
I'm proud of some of the efforts that they do on that.
Oh, and a level of collaboration and resilience and trust.
Huge learning in that.
There's lots of good words that you can use to describe a theatre show, but I really believe it. They do tend to be very, very good for students' development.
Now, our walk is finished, but our talk is not. Your office or my office?
Try mine?
Yeah.
We might have
a bit more quiet.
We might have Mr. Dinham up there. We might not.
So I'm keen to learn a bit more about directing. So in the time that we've been working together, I've been very lucky that I've had a couple of productions with you as my assistant director, and how thankful am I for that? Cannot explain in words.
Thank you.
But I think the most recent one that we worked together, in terms of how we worked and the work process we had, I think was possibly my most successful. The most successful production that I've worked on, and I put that entirely down to teamwork.
We had a very good team for that one.
So, for the context of explaining to people listening, we did Lord of the Flies. It's a play that I've been trying to work out how to put on for years and years. And I've had some really cool concepts in my mind. But essentially what we did was we handed over the creative rights to the students, at least in ensemble. And that was headed up by you. And away from ensemble, I headed up the scripted lines.
Yeah.
So I just think that it was a phenomenal success, because the biggest success that came from that project for me was that the students owned that production. Mm. And instead of being the students that got told how to do it by the teacher, they really did own it, and they felt that all the creative decisions, at least if not final decision made by them, they were being listened to with all their decisions along the way.
Yes.
That was down to you. That's me watching the way you work. So is that something you learnt from uni, or is that just a personal philosophy?
A bit of an amalgamation. I think I got a lot better at approaching things that way and getting out of the way from uni. I think the VCA course was really, really good at saying, get ready enough that you can approach it any way you like. And then when something good is happening, get out of the road. Just listen to your actors, basically. You know, you may well be able to relate to this. But early on, a show was an excuse for me to transpose my ideas onto a group of people for the audience. If I had a cool idea, a creative technique, something I was trying to get across, I used the show as an excuse to do that, rather than necessarily respecting the show for what it was as its own creative entity. And that meant that I bossed actors around a lot. I had a very specific way that I wanted it done that maybe ended up being quite an impressive show, and maybe it didn't. But what happened more often was the actors lost some autonomy. They became a very effective, but still autonomous, not autonomous tool to do things. They would do exactly as I said, at the level that I said for the line in the creative moment.
You're making puppets.
A little bit. And I don't think actors like to work like that. I definitely don't see their best work when they've been told every bit of it has to go a certain way.
I don't think people like to work like that.
I mean, no, that's exactly right. But we impose this idea of the word director, meaning the one who directs people to do other things. Mm. And so they kind of mentally will default to that unless you explicitly set the parameters that they won't. And early on, I got that wrong a bunch. And then the VCA's training gave me a really good vocabulary for how to not do that. A couple of rules I basically never break when I'm in a rehearsal room. I never tell someone what I want. I'm not like, I really feel like it needs or wants to go here. That's not about me anymore. I will lay the foundation that an exercise, a warm up, a rehearsal will allow something spontaneous or creative to happen. And if I've done the preparatory work, it'll be on theme and it'll be symbolic in one way or another of something that we've already discussed. You've got to invite the whole room into that process. If you don't, if you say, oh, well, I really want it to be a really, you know, collaborative, tribal, they take over the island and I want you to do that. It's about what you want and them trying to seek your approval to do that well.
Yeah.
And most students default to that anyway. They tend to seek approval in one way or another, be it via good grades or that you've noticed them or whatever they've got going on. They tend to want to show you something good. Mm. Yeah, I think a grade four is the perfect example of this. Every grade four subject I've ever taught, every few minutes somebody's like, I did this, check it out. They've got a sheet or a pencil or whatever it is.
And that can be exhausting.
Oh,
especially if you condone that as well. If you're looking for that all the time, then it's just adding extra work for you.
Absolutely. And then you're exactly right in a show. If you've let that go on too long and you've directed everything and you've got your kind of really tight grasp on it,
the mistakes are way more obvious.
Way more obvious. And if you don't let people's input and then right at the end be like, okay, well, I'm gone, they can flounder really badly because they're so used to having something to hold on to in the process.
Mm.
So for Lord of the Flies, I think I did it better than I have done in the past. But I asked a lot of questions. I very rarely in the ensemble room would tell people that this was good or bad, the kind of reductive language that there's a set expectation.
And I've really been trying to grab on that as well. So we'll just take a little bit of an aside on that. The good and the bad feature has been a theme for my year, having taken that leaf from your book. It often when we watch a production, or even if we see an exercise in class and in class activity, we see students perform and then we look for feedback from the rest of the class, we instantly jump to the good or the bad. Was it good or was it not good?
Yeah.
and explain a little bit more about this concept and how we can expand our vocabulary to be more curious and observant.
I directly stole something called the critical response process, which is stages of new performance, artists asking for feedback from the audience. But a lot of the origin of that method was that a lot of audiences in feedback, the writer behind that, Liz Lerman, would notice audiences saying, "Oh, I really liked this bit." And that's rarely what an artist needs to hear, because they're not making a show for just that one person. And it's also usually quite subjective. "Oh, I don't like naturalism, so I didn't like this show." And you can't build off that. Mm. That language is already reductive. Dismissive. To the point of being pointless. Even if everyone's really respectful and nobody takes it the wrong way, you still don't get a very fruitful conversation out of it. So the language I use now is when people are devising work, especially in an ensemble, things that were striking, things that were noticeable, things that sparked my imagination, things that were curious. Now, those are all kind of spun to sound sort of positive, but they're really not. I can be curious about finding out more about this thing without having commented on the quality of the performance yet at all. The key is yet. Eventually, you want to get to a critical point where you're able to talk about whether or not the impact that is intended is working on the audience. Mm. But removing good and bad from that and having them give each other that feedback, I really noticed this moment stood out to me. And the other one is what I want more of. I've heard this said like for schools as stars and wishes. Somebody at a drama conference said that version of it. And the stars, the things that were shiny, the things that stood out to me, and the wishes I wanted more of.
Yeah.
But whatever
I
language
quite like
it was,
that. I might nick that.
Yeah, do. Yeah. I find it really helpful, especially in junior years drama, because one of the hardest things to do in teenagers is to manifest the confidence that they can get up and perform something without feeling judged.
Big time.
And so that language can, if everyone does it all the time, a lot of the judging language is already gone from the room before you need to even talk about the show or self-reflect on the show.
And I love this so much, because here is a connection that I made years and years ago, and yet if you're not involved in drama, you may not see this connection, that what we're talking about right now for shows translates over into everyday life. Mm. And it goes all the way back to the how to win friends and influence people. If you can be really observant in drama and do well in drama, socially you should be able to get ahead in the rest of the world. So that whole question that always gets asked by the one student in the room, how's this going to help me in the real world? Or when am I ever going to use this after school?
Especially later on, after I've got some pretty impressive grades in something that's more of a core subject.
So yeah. Well, this is how it's going to help you. If you can understand on effective forms of feedback, if you can get something from someone or get something more, or be able to tell someone that they might be lacking or they need to build on something without having language that takes away their dignity or makes it feel like they've been judged, you can just have an easier time of life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the you've hit on the buzzword of the last sort of 5 or 6 years, which is resilience and grit. Mm. There were a lot of conversations about resilience and grit. And I think I've extrapolated them to mean students who are able to recognize areas of improvement without taking a knock to their ego in a really substantial way, because if there's a right and a wrong, if there's that concrete line and they fail and they beat themselves up because they fail, and
it's definite.
Really easy to feel that in a competitive private school environment as well, then they don't go, "I will become better at this by working on the skill." They say, "I suck at this and I hate it."
And fixed mindset.
Immediately a fixed mindset instead of a growth mindset, which is where I was going next. Thank you. Because it's a really good way of thinking about it. And I don't know if I agree with all of the different parameters people said about the way resilience works necessarily, but I think just generally speaking, if you're able to look at things you're not so great at yet and not mind that and keep improving.
Understand that in the future, your performance will be different from what it is today.
Yeah, that's right. Any sort of steep learning curve. It's weird. I've noticed that a lot more in my own life, separate to school recently, that I default to a fixed mindset instantly, and then I have to kind of work at it to unwind that. I don't want to do this thing because I'm not good at it yet. which is interesting. It never used to happen. I used to just chuck myself at things, and now I have a, for better or worse, I have a more set expectation of what I'm good at. Mm. And so going way out of my comfort zone is actually kind of hard. I find it difficult.
Well, interestingly on that, I believe I've always had a growth mindset. I used to love starting new things and feeling that learning curve go up really quickly. So especially with sport, I've always been very sporty, and I've always had the feedback when I start a new sport, oh, you're really good for a beginner. And that lasts for about 6 months. Everyone's amazed at what you can perform in 6 months. And then as you continue to perform, that diminishing return happens. Mm. He's like, oh, I've been playing for 3 years, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, he's not bad.
You're fine. You kept at it,
and that's usually when I drop off.
Yes.
And it's only really since I've got into my 30s that I've now found new pleasure in looking to the next step. So not mastery. I don't feel like I'm a master at anything yet, but I do feel like I've got off that beginner platform and started to dig deeper into the diminishing returns. So actually sticking with something, even though you don't get that massive payback. Directing would be one. So I believe now that I'm starting to refine what I'm doing with directing school plays. I feel that if someone threw a school play at me, I'm very confident that with the resources I could have, I could put something together.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been able to do that 5 years. I would have needed a lot more scaffolding with people around me.
Yeah. That makes sense. Like that's about where you want to be, I think. I mean, you never stop learning a show.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever done a show where I was like, ah, well, that was good and I didn't need to do anything else.
Yeah.
It doesn't
always exist.
Always.
I'd like to know how that feeling that I'm only learning now in my 30s, I can package as a teacher and deliver to a teenager. And if that's even possible, because every single teenager has the story of their parent or adult saying, oh, you can't tell them anything, And I remember my dad saying that all the time, I can't teach you anything, you know everything. And he just lost the fact that I needed to learn that for myself.
Yeah.
And maybe that is part of the growth, is that I'm only getting to this stage now because of all those mistakes that I've made, and those mistakes were the valuable lesson.
Yeah.
Sometimes if you can teach someone your mistakes, it's not going to be as powerful a lesson as if they actually live it.
I think that's a really good point, because take a more like a health-based, holistic kind of approach. I think we recognize now, staying in reasonable amount of shape, getting exercise, drinking lots of water, getting decent sleep, for people in our age bracket, that is just common sense and obvious because we've got it wrong and improved from it, right? But if you're 15 and somebody says you should meditate to calm yourself down, the stigma around that and the idea that sitting still and quiet for 20 minutes has any sort of benefit at all when your mind is racing many different directions constantly, it's very hard to see that as good advice, even if it works, because what things have gone wrong or have been really difficult because you couldn't do it. I think about sleep as well. Students should get, 8 to 10 hours of sleep or whatever
it's,
it is.
It's a lot more than adults. 10 hours being much closer to the
is
number.
Is it really?
Yeah,
right.
And they shouldn't be waking up early. I mean, that's a conversation for a whole other day. But the idea of trying to get students into school at 8 a.m., I mean, that realistically, if we look at their circadian rhythms, and I haven't read deeply into this. I've read at an elementary level.
I'm sure you know more than me.
They should really start school at about 10 a.m. And continue on. So the hours of schooling work in our 9-to-5 modern day world actually are not the most beneficial to their learning. They need a lot more sleep early in the morning.
Yeah. I'd be curious to know more about it.
I'd like to read more, actually.
It makes a logical sense to me, though. And the other point I'm making with that is that which kid has not pushed it, played video games, watched Netflix, whatever, stayed up reading sometimes till 12, 1, 2 in the morning, and then done the next day, and the next day's felt relatively the same. Like there's no direct lesson from that says, don't do this, it's really bad for you. If we did that, tomorrow would be horrible. I would have a horrible day tomorrow if I'd stayed up till 2 or 3 in the morning on a computer. Like I would genuinely feel it really acutely. They just don't. They're much more robust in bouncing up. And it doesn't mean it's not doing something bad for them. I don't think it's a good habit, but they don't notice. So it's really hard to teach a lesson that you've experienced that is true for you now in your 30s, that a 15-year-old or a 14-year-old or a 12-year-old is going to have some grasp of meaning, which makes me wonder which ways in which we teach are default methods of us having learned things ourselves and are now adults that don't translate to students, because it's very hard to know consistently whether or not you're doing a good job.
If I speak to you and say, think back at your schooling, what did you learn? You're more than likely not going to think about an academic class that you were sitting in on Thursday afternoon, period five. No. You're going to think about the moments where you had an interaction with a teacher and they said something inspirational, or they said or did something that stayed with you, positive or negative. But that's where the real learning happened, in terms of how the usable information that you have for your life. I mean, I remember one of my teachers, I did something wrong, completely did something wrong, and in a group, and he scolded the group, had five of us standing in front of him. And he said, he was asking questions and I was responding, yep, sorry, that was me, sorry. And he pulled me aside after that and said, by the way, you've got an invitation to the leadership program. And I sort of looked at him perplexed. He said, you took responsibility for your action. The action is not the thing that we look at. Everyone makes mistakes. But it was how you dealt with it to then own the behavior. Mm. I use that in my teaching because I was 16 when it happened. Yeah. But more than 16 years after that, I'm still using that conversation in my own practice.
It's a great one. I think most people can think of one that stands out like that as well. And it's a real indication that what students recognize and follow, even if they need the content eventually, it's rarely the content that sticks with them longer term. Mm. And it's, I would, more dangerous ground, but I would suggest that the content is often even secondary to those moments of life shaping that can happen. And I think most teachers will relate to the idea of watching out for the ones that might not go that way. And they might not have some good path. It's not that you want them to have a specific good path. Here you go. Just the ones that are really battling in one way or another tend to hit your radar more often because you really want to steer it right. Mm. I think it's partly because of that those memories that you build around teachers and teaching in school. First of all, you spend a tremendously long time there. 12 years of your life is, for a lot of people, that is the thing that they spend the most time on. For a really long time, until probably you have kids, and then you have kids for that whole time, and you've had them for longer. I think the point of that being that my favourite one of those stories that stood out to me is actually my friend's. I'm going to steal his story instead of my own one. But he was a really top-end math student, so he's one of five, I think, doing the extended maths two. It's the equivalent of the highest maths we've got here, but for the New South Wales system. And he was the one of the five that was battling with this concept at the time. They were all very strong, but he, for whatever reason, was finding it hard to have this one thing stick. And the story he tells us of the teacher at the time, Mr. Hartman, trying to relate to him in a different way in explaining this way this graphed curve would work. Now, I don't know enough about maths to pretend to know the terms, but he gave the example of the... It was like, you're a surfer, right? You surf outside of school. So here, imagine this is you at this point of the wave and this is you at this point of the wave and it's going up in this trajectory. The way to calculate this, and he said it's always stuck out to him, not because he learned the concept any better or even that he, listened even especially well in that moment. He just remembered it because the guy knew something about him, like that he was a unique person, not just an individual student to be dismissed at the end of the day. He knew that he surfed, and that he said that was it. That was enough for me to want to keep trying hard for this guy who was teaching us, because he had one small moment of personality there. And that was it. Like that, he didn't need much more than that. He was also a great teacher. Mr. Hartman was kind of famous for being the maths teacher of our school, but I think that may be why he was such a great teacher, is that he'd bothered to learn something about a student enough that they felt recognised in a room of the most competitive people, and he was the one who wasn't doing well at this thing. So it was a really opportune moment for him to give up on it. If he'd been beat up by it, or a teacher had been unduly strict and said, "You clearly don't get it, so you're going to come back here after class and do another 2 hours until you get it," like that wouldn't have helped him in that particular moment. But knowing something about him and trying to make some kind of relatable example out of it was enough that it stuck with him. And I just love that story because it...
And it goes back to, I've said this in previous episodes, just learning a student's name is the start.
Yeah.
You learn your students' names and then everything cascades from there. So if you can do that first small detail, then everything becomes easier after that. That's a perfect anecdote for that. The best place to learn about your students, school productions, because often it's out of school context, so that's an opportunity that you can meet your students in a more relaxed setting and learn about them, and then use that information to help them with their acting, because you need to know about their life experiences, so you can try and tap into that and say, try and assimilate that into some of their performances.
Yeah, and relate ideas to other things that harder to do in a classroom, I think.
Mm.
It can be, at least depending on the classroom, but I think it's there's an opportunity immediately there if you're doing a school show that you ask people what they thought of something. You're already inviting them into a conversation by asking, how was that experience? Did you connect with this character's moment? Inviting them into a conversation about what creative thing might happen next. And the output as well is not to be underestimated, because at the end of it they do a show, which is maybe the most gratifying bit of the close to the whole experience, which a classroom doesn't have necessarily. You can do a showcase, I guess, or this school is pretty good for like music students and following up on awards for people who've done a really good job on something additional to regular classwork. But regular normal classwork most of the time doesn't have a big applauded output at the end of it, and that can relatively make them less interesting and harder to kind of maintain. It's interesting.
The production this year provided a few extra benefits, even though they wouldn't present themselves immediately as extra benefits. So we've already spoken about doing Lord of the Flies, and it, for at least for me, and it sounds like for you, one of the most successful school productions that you've ever put on, definitely for me. And yet we didn't get to put it on. And yet that was possibly the thing that bonded the cast and crew the most. I've never seen this in a school production, how tight that friendship group that was originally just a cast of a play became a friendship group. Very tight. Mm. And I have very rarely seen that happen so quickly.
Mm.
And COVID-19 memorably was a reason for that, because we got shut down on our dress rehearsal night.
Yeah, which became our first and last performance.
Last performance, and we filmed it. So at least they had the video for it. But that hardship, and I'm adamant with this concept, and I'd love to learn about a little bit more about it. Going through hardship with another person will bring you close to that person.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's true in loads of examples. It's interesting that moment happened for that cast during pandemic times, because it also had the opportunity, or possibility at least, to wreck everything, make them really despondent about the show, give up on the final output. Like you could imagine a world in which a group of students who put a bunch of effort into something had the opportunity to do a performance and then didn't get to do it, and so didn't care about the final output anymore. And it's a credit to them that they were resilient enough to find some enjoyment in that performance, as opposed to waiting for the audience's applause, which is then what gives them a gratifying thing.
So, yeah, no, exactly. That's extrinsic motivation, whereas they had intrinsic motivation in droves.
Mm. But I think to their own credit, I couldn't pretend to take much of the credit for that at all. I think that was just them running with it really, really well.
They were a very strong group. All right, final thoughts. We've spoken about what we have done. I'm very keen to know what you want to do. What's next? And on this journey of yours, where do you see yourself, either immediately, so near future or far future?
Great question. It's a tricky time thinking about shows and arts and cultural things because everything's shut at the moment. Mm. I really want to do another show. I've got itchy feet for a show. I mean, in school and out of school, I'm just keen and ready to do creative thinking. Really enjoying looking at the next middle years productions coming up here because I get to just go into director mode even a little bit, thinking about it and working with Ryan, who I'm keen to work with. I think he's got a really good director.
The new head of drama?
Yes, the new head of faculty. What do I want to do? Some increased capacity of shaping program, I think, is going to really tickle my brain in the right way. The moment I kind of write within the year, or a semester or a term subject, I quite enjoy the nerding out on how do you structure this thing for 10 or 20 weeks. I really like thinking about it as a full system and using that kind of backwards by design. Well, in 20 weeks, they have to know this set of skills. So what's the most interesting creative way I can get them from not knowing that to knowing it? I'd love to implement that on a bigger scale, whether it's in a school or not, I'm not sure, but I've done work in youth theatres where you can craft a very good early years to after school to summer school program to you've got a youth ensemble group who are going to keep coming back to do the performances up until they're 18 or 20 or 25 or whatever it is. But you can do a really interesting thing from if you've got the same group of people and you manage to keep them for all that long, 7 and 8 year olds through to 25. Imagine if you're doing the same theatre crew with that consistent group of people for that period of time. Goes back to the start of our conversation about amounts of time spent on a subject or in a specific environment. Something about the extracurricular, like a sports team who plays together for 6 years. Geez, they're good. They're really good. They're better in a kind of intangible way, more even than their skill set, because they know each other so well. And I want an excuse to work in that world, be it through sports or drama or teaching, but excuse.
Would you create something like that yourself, or would you join a team?
I'd be happy joining the team, but I don't know where that team is. I think it's a really unique way of doing things. I think I'd like to create it eventually. I don't know if I'm quite ready to delve into trying to do an arts theatre company in Australia at the moment, considering how dried up and difficult the funding, the process and the follow-on from education and arts stuff from the government at the moment has been pretty dismal. So having to fight that while you're doing something you really love is hard, I think. I wouldn't want... I don't know, maybe I will anyway, but... I think that'd be really hard at the moment.
Would you ever consider doing that rural again?
Yeah, I think I would. I don't know where, though. I don't think I'd go back to where I was. Mm. It would feel like a return to something, but I've got new experience now. I think that wouldn't fit right, but a rural or regional placement somewhere.
I'd love to see that concept. I mean, I'm also keen to move back rural too at some point in my life, and that could be a potential... program or project that you could do. I mean, I'd be interested in that as well.
Mm. It's a big commitment in time.
Yes.
To be in one place for that long. I mean, I think you'd really have to find the right place. I would, at least. I don't think just going to anywhere and setting it up would ring right, even if it worked, because I would have to have some way of connecting my life and world with that place. But if there was one, geez, it'd be cool.
Look out. Watch this space. Remy, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And hopefully we'll continue to have these off the air. But I always learn more when I'm around you, and I've become a much better teacher just with you around me. So
thank you.
Thank you.